If blood spatter analysis has no basis in science, why is it being used to sentence people to death? Do prosecutors care more about justice or their spotless record? And what really happened the night that Julie Reyes' son was brutally and ruthlessly murdered? I'm Zach, your host of The Aux. Let's get into it. What's going on, guys? It is good to be back in the studio. Fuck that. It is great to be back in the studio. I was doing a bit of traveling abroad with my significant other, and now I am back in Brooklyn, back to let it rip. And today we are talking about why blood spatter analysis is bullshit, and more specifically, the case of Julie Reyes. Julie Reyes. And I'm going to be referring to an article by Pamela Koloff, and you can search this if you want to follow along, because I'll be referencing this article throughout the podcast. It is called Bloodstain Analysis Convinced a Jury She Stabbed Her 10-Year-Old Son. This is an article in ProPublica by Pamela Koloff. Again, you can search the title of that article if you want to follow along. I'm also going to link this in the audio description and the video description wherever you are watching this. So let's dive into this shit, because this is wild, this is crazy, this is brutal, and we're going to dissect this. This is I read this article a few weeks ago before I went abroad, and I've been chomping at the bit to dive into it. So this is how the article opens up. I tucked Joel in, but I feel so guilty I didn't hold him longer, Julie Reyes said, her voice welling with emotion. That is all she can muster about the worst night of her life. As she tries to say more, she breaks down. The story remains still almost unspeakable. In the early morning hours of October 13, 1997, Reyes was jolted awake by a scream. She discovered an intruder, but saw no sign of her son in her Lawrenceville, Illinois home. She told police that she struggled with a man who fled, then ran for help, but it was too late. Her son, 10-year-old Joel Kirkpatrick, had been stabbed to death. At the time of the murder, Rhea was a single mother working toward a doctorate in educational psychology. She had divorced Joel's father 3 years earlier and was leading a quiet, uneventful life in the wake of a turbulent marriage. The mild-mannered daughter of missionaries, Rhea had devoted herself to her bright, inquisitive son. But in 2000, after a protracted and deeply flawed investigation, Rhea was charged with killing Joel. She was charged with killing her son. That is how the article opens up. Holy fucking shit. This woman, who was in the wake of a divorce, she was at home with her son. All of a sudden, her son is brutally murdered, stabbed to death. We're going to get into the details. And now, this is the written overview, the written analysis of everything that went wrong. Some things went right, but most things went wrong in this trial. A lot of it had to do with shoddy police work. We're going to get into the blood spatter analysis and how bullshit it actually is. And coming into this episode, I thought that blood spatter analysis, whatever you want to call it, I thought this was a very precise way to look at a murder, to look at a homicide investigation, because I grew up watching CSI, Dexter later on, and the way that blood spatter analysis is portrayed in the media on Netflix is that it is an accurate, precise retelling of what exactly occurred physically. Whether it's a suicide or a murder, there's basically a one-to-one translation between how the blood spatter is laid out and the events that occurred leading up to that blood spatter, and that investigators could come in, take photos of it, analyze the patterns, the way it's laid against the wall, the frequency of the splatter, the spread of the splatter, all the shit that goes into it, and you could basically look at that and get a snapshot of what exactly happened. And after reading this, I know that is definitely not the case It is not the case. And I wanted to say, before we get into the actual murder and the evidence or lack of evidence, just right off the bat, hearing the lead up to what happened, hearing this introduction, reading the introduction of this article, if you're going to kill your son, if you decide, like, let's say that Julie Rea was 100% guilty. If you're going to kill your son, would it really be in the aftermath of the rough divorce once you find peace? Like, once you go through all of that tough shit, once you go through the back and forth with the lawyers, you're probably having screaming matches with your husband, whatever, you're going through all the shit that they show behind the scenes in Marriage Story between Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver. And I've never been through a divorce, so that is my only concept of what a divorce is. And it looks pretty fucking ugly physically and psychologically and emotionally. If I'm going to commit one of the most heinous crimes known to mankind, I'm probably going to do it during the actual turbulent time that I'm going through. So right off the bat, it doesn't fit that, like, once she settled with the divorce and, you know, that's behind her and she's in the middle of getting her doctorate and now she's living with her son, like, once that kind of settles out, why murder your son in cold blood then? Like, if you're going to do it, which the evidence clearly shows that she didn't, you do it when your life is a shit show. Why, like, you don't, your life isn't going well. Like, you don't get past a divorce. You don't have, you know, you're not in the middle of your PhD. Like, you don't go home to your son and things are going really well. And your son's like, hey, what's for breakfast? Mom, what's for breakfast before you go on to the job that you always wanted to do, getting your doctorate in psychology? Like, is it Captain Crunch or Fruit Loops? And then you just look at your son and you're like, damn, I want to fucking kill this son of a bitch. Like, that is not how it goes. If you're going to do something like that, it's going to be when you're in the middle of a shitstorm, I would think. Again, I know nothing. I'm just talking about my own human experience when the times where the thought has crossed my mind where I'm just like, I could really do some damage to this person. Like, I've never killed someone, but I'm just like, this person deserves to get the shit beat out of them. Or like, when the darkest thoughts cross my mind, usually my life is not going well. Like, I'm in the middle of something difficult, so it doesn't add up. Also, she's a single mom. Do single moms have time to plan murders? I know single moms have murdered people. But if you're going, if you have a job, if you're getting a degree, if you also have a son and you have to come home, make your son dinner, make yourself dinner, you know, maybe you're going on dates, you're going to see friends occasionally, where are you fitting in your time for plotting your son's demise? Just doesn't add up. Just doesn't add up. So let's get into the actual murder. Let's get into the actual, the meat of the details. The details of the meat. The entree. On the morning of October 13th, 1997, a neighbor, Lisa Bridget, awoke around 4:30 in the morning to the sound of Rea pounding on her front door. And again, Rea is the mom who's accused of killing her son. So Rea was standing outside, barefoot, clad in a t-shirt and underwear. She looked frantic and she was speaking so rapidly that it was hard to understand. Hoping to calm her, Bridget pulled the 28-year-old into a bear hug. "Joel's gone," Rea shrieked. The court records show she told police she'd run into Joel's room after hearing a scream and saw only his empty bed. A man in a ski mask lunged at her. Ugh. And Rea, who had a black belt in Taekwondo, good for her. Rhea struggled with him, chasing him through the house and into the backyard. He slammed her head to the ground before making his escape. Hysterical, she told Bridget she thought Joel had been kidnapped. But when Lawrence County Deputy Sheriff Dennis York arrived and searched Rhea's home, he found Joel. The fifth grader lay on his bedroom floor between his empty bed and a nearby wall. His pajamas were drenched in blood. He had been stabbed 12 times, twice through his aorta. So literally, this boy was stabbed through his fucking heart. Like, absolutely horrific, cold-blooded scene. The worst day of your life. No doubt about it. As a mother, the absolute worst nightmare is to walk into a situation like this. Not only walk into a situation like this, but be in the middle of it actually happening, where this guy breaks into your house, stabs your son, struggles with you. You still have no idea what happened to your son because she was struggling with a guy downstairs, the intruder downstairs. This dude gets away for the time being. And the police come and you come back, go back upstairs, and your son is just laying in a pool of his own blood. This is fucking, it's horrific. Another thing, if you murder a child, if you murder your own child, again, hypothetically, are you really going to your neighbor's door, banging on your neighbor's door in the morning with your kid's body still warm, alerting your neighbor and saying, I need help, whatever, what happened, screaming? It just doesn't seem, just right off the bat, before we even get into any of the scientific evidence that was proposed in this trial, the situation, like, if I'm a police officer, and again, I have zero experience, I'm just a dumb motherfucker talking on a podcast, if I know that this woman, you know, saw her child murdered, or, you know, without any motive yet, so let's say she saw her child murdered by someone, could have been her, could have been someone else, is the first thing you do as a person who's trying to get away with it, go bang on your neighbor's door in the middle of the morning right after you committed the crime? Like, you're going to Casey Anthony this situation. You're going to dispose of the body. You're going to hide it. You're going to lie about it. You're going to wait until people start reporting, I haven't seen the kid in school, none of his friends have seen him for weeks, and then, you know, maybe the cops discover the body later, like they did with Casey Anthony. Like, it just doesn't add up what this woman did if she is a murderer. And I also went through some of the track records of violent murders of children committed by the parents. And so when you do have a violent murder of a child and the parent is the perpetrator, almost all of the cases that I came across involved some sort of demon or spirit that the parent thought inhabited the child. So it was some fucking crazy, insane parent that said, you know, my child's inhabited by the demon the spirit of a serpent or something. And then they stabbed their child to death and threw them in the river. Some fucked up shit like that. The other times when it's not a violent murder, when it doesn't involve like a stabbing or a close range gunshot wound with a child, every case that I came across was smothering or drowning. Like, it takes a special type of person to, like a special sick type of person to drive a knife into your own child's heart. Like, that is a fucking, just absolutely fucked up, just brutally hellish thing to do. And I don't know if there's a way to do that other than being just insane and thinking that your child is possessed by a demonic spirit, which is probably, there's probably something to that. Like, if most parents kill their child by smothering them or drowning them, it's probably because they don't want to look at their kid's face. Like, you have to, If you're going to smother someone with a pillow, you're not really looking at your kid. Like, you can, if you're sick enough, you can block it out. You can, you don't want to look in their face. You don't want to have that experience as a parent. Like, you're already fucked up enough to the point where you want to kill your kid. If you're drowning them, if you're holding their head underwater, if you're smothering them with a pillow, you have some sort of barrier between your child and the experience. When you stab someone in the chest, you're looking right at them. You're feeling the blood. It's spurting on you. It's like all this fucked up shit that I imagine, you know, happens internally with your organs, with the aorta. Like, it's just, you have to be a special type of sick fuck to do something like that. And again, right after you do that, are you going to go running to your neighbor, banging on the door, saying, help me, help me? Probably not. A plotting investigation followed with few leads. The murder weapon, which was a steak knife pulled from a butcher's block in Reyes' kitchen, did not yield any fingerprints. Investigators had little to go on, having failed to do basic police work that might have pinpointed the identity of an intruder. They never dusted Joel's bedroom or the butcher block that the knife was pulled from. For fingerprints, they never dusted Joel's bedroom or the butcher block the knife was pulled from for fingerprints, and did not preserve critical trace evidence on Joel's bedspread. So no evidence was preserved in the room. They didn't pull fingerprints near or around the butcher's block, the murder weapon, and instead they focused on Rhea. Looking for any remnants of blood that she might have tried to wash away, investigators dug up her septic tank, inspected her sink and shower drains, and examined the clothes in her washing machine. They sprayed luminol, which is a chemical that detects the presence of blood, around her house. They found nothing. So, I mean, I have no problem with the investigators trying to look for blood. That seems like something that you would do in a normal procedure. You check the shower drains, you check the sink drains, you look at the clothes, you know, whatever, you spray shit around, you look for presence of blood. They found nothing. The fucking insane part of this to me is they didn't dust the murder room. The room where the murder happens. Like, I'm not a police investigator. Again, I'm just a fucking podcaster reading articles and then talking about them and trying to do it in some sort of insightful, hopefully entertaining manner. If I became a police investigator tomorrow and I found a kid stabbed in a room upstairs in a house, the first thing I would say is, shouldn't we do that CSI thing where we dust the room for prints? Isn't this the time to do the fingerprinting? Like, I've only been working here for one day. But it just seems like, you know, where the room is covered in blood and where this body is lying and we're trying to figure out who did it, we should probably collect the stuff in and around the body. I'm just saying. Hey, though, I've only been here for one day. Just going out on a limb here and saying we should examine the room where the murder happened. This is like, if someone gets murdered in a room and you don't collect evidence from the room, that's like if SpaceX blew up one of their rockets. Like, you're watching a launch on TV. A SpaceX rocket goes up and it's the first one that's trying to reach Mars with astronauts on it. And it just blows up like the Challenger on television. And everyone at SpaceX is like, I think it was the rocket. Like, Elon, do you think we should check the scraps of the rocket? Like, look at all the debris that was burning up and, you know, maybe examine it. Maybe examine the evidence, the aftermath of this terrible thing that happened, which is the rocket explosion. Do you think it's a problem with the rocket, Elon? And Elon Musk is like, nah, I think it was the wind. Everyone at SpaceX is like, what? Like, there's wind every day. It was clearly the rocket. We should probably look for the evidence in the rubble. And Elon's like, nah, it was probably the wind. Like, that is what this seems like with the police investigators in the murder room. Like, there had to be some intern when the head investigator walked into the murder room and was like, yeah, I've seen enough. And the intern was like, do you think we should, like, get a fingerprint or something? Like, there's a guy's ID right there in a pool of blood. Should we get that ID and run it? Like, it looks like he dropped his entire wallet and some of his personal belongings in the middle of the murder scene. And the head investigator's like, dude, shut the fuck up. Like, you've been working here for one day. You think just because this dude dropped his wallet in a pile of human remains and blood that that's going to lead us to the guy who did it? Like, no, it was obviously the mom. Come on, dude. You know I have to stick with my first hunch. I can't be collecting evidence that goes against what I already told my friends. That's ridiculous. So, Jesus Christ. Like, they didn't collect fingerprints from the block, and they did not preserve any critical evidence in the room or from Joel's bedspread. Again, Joel is the kid who was murdered, and they didn't collect any evidence from that room. You know, seems off. So let's get into the actual blood spatter analysis, because, again, this is something that I thought was rock solid. Again, I grew up with this idea of it in my head from TV shows, from reading books, whatever. Just like, there's always that moment on television where they're analyzing the murder and they see the dots on the wall, the specks of blood, and someone has this like, and they look at the specks of blood and they start seeing the past, and it's like, oh my God, I'm seeing the events through the lens of the blood spatter. And then they figure out just instantly in that moment what blood spatter was. And my stupid ass was like, that is how it works. That is exactly how things go when you're solving a murder. So this is what the article says about blood spatter analysis. So blood spatter analysis is rooted in the belief that the drops, spatters, and trails of blood at a crime scene are rich repositories of information that can be used to reverse engineer and even reconstruct crimes. Many practitioners that are law enforcement officers, not scientists. Many practitioners of blood spatter analysis are law enforcement officers and not scientists, but their expert testimony often lends a sense of scientific certainty to circumstantial cases, and it can be a powerful tool in the hands of prosecutors. Blood spatter analysis sounds a lot like the Krav Maga of forensics. Like, Krav Maga is like this self-defense martial arts where all of these guys, like these martial arts experts online, they pay people to attack them in sequence with knives and guns that aren't loaded, and they know exactly what this person's going to do because they're being paid, they're part of the video. And then this self-defense expert Krav Maga dude, just, you know, as the person's extending the gun, they do this like fucking Harry Potter eyewash, like grab of the gun and twist it and pull it out of the guy's hand and bop them over the head and twist their arm, put them on the ground. And it all happens in like 3 seconds. And this is like the 1,000th take that these two guys did trying to get to that point. And you can search these kind of bullshit self-defense videos online on TikTok, YouTube, whatever. They're entire compilations of people giving this advice that if you don't know a lot about self-defense, and again, I'm not an expert. I've taken Muay Thai for almost 2 years now. I'm in no way an expert. I have some defense, some experience with grappling, some knife defense, and no way an expert. But this like whole, there's like an entire industry of people that make a living putting out these terrible, shoddy, and honestly dangerous videos showing people how to just disarm an intruder or disarm a pickpocket or something that puts a gun to your head with like this flashy bullshit technique that doesn't actually work in real life. This is what blood spatter analysis sounds like to me. It's like the shitty Krav Maga self-defense of the forensics world, where if you just explain blood spatter analysis to someone and you tell them like, yeah, you could see what happened with the murder if you just pay attention to the dots, like you just retrace the dots like a story. On the surface, it's like, oh yeah, like 100%, like the blood's coming from the body, you know, it makes sense that it would tell the story of the murder. And then when you look into it, like we're about to, you see that it is complete bullshit. It is dangerous. People are suffering. They are having their lives destroyed through this pseudoscience of blood spatter analysis. The retired biochemist and forensic scientist Robert Shaler, S-H-A-L-E-R, Robert Shaler, one of the authors of the 2009 National Academy of Sciences report and the founding director of Pennsylvania State University's Forensic Science Program, testified for the defense in the CAM case that experts on both sides were incorrect. And the CAM case is another case mentioned in the article that we won't get into the specifics, but it also involved blood spatter analysis. So he says both sides of the case, the experts were incorrect. So both blood spatter experts were wrong. He says the specks of blood, he argued, was too little information from which to draw any meaningful conclusion. Quote, the experts couldn't even agree on the type of pattern they were looking at. So a biochemist, a forensic scientist, this dude is a legitimate expert, and he's not saying like, no, one of the dudes was wrong in this trial for blood spatter analysis. He was saying these guys were looking at the same exact shit, the same exact pictures, photos of the crime scene, and they were both seeing different things. So it's like ink blot paintings. When you think about it, like looking at blood spatter and trying to put someone away to death, it's like you're sentencing someone to the electric chair based on an ink block painting, and it's like the first thing you see is going to be the thing that you stick with, and then once you see it, it's almost impossible to unsee. So it's ridiculous. When Rhea stood trial for her son's murder in February 2002, bloodstain pattern analysis took center stage. Like Cam's case, which is the case I just mentioned we won't get into, Rhea's case hinged on a minuscule amount of blood that stained her t-shirt on the night of the slaying. Nearly all of it was her blood, which had seeped from the wound on her arm. But a tiny smear on her shirt's right shoulder was found to be Joel's blood. DNA testing of two other small blood stains on her shirt established a possible, though not definitive, link to Joel. The defense would argue that Joel's blood had likely transferred onto Rhea's shirt when she scuffled with the bloody intruder. So there were a couple spots of blood on Rhea's shirt. And yeah, you know, that is evidence of something possible, you know, that she got it during the encounter with her son, or, you know, her story, which seems like it would hold up in this case. A guy just stabbed her son through the heart and then scuffled with her. Like, that guy's dripping in blood. Like, the same way you run into your apartment when it's pouring rain out and your clothes are just seeping all over the floor. I imagine that's what happens with blood when you stab someone multiple times through the heart. The prosecution called two bloodstain pattern analysts who asserted that there had been no intruder. The first was Rod Englert, a retired police detective and past president of the International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts. He began by performing a lengthy demonstration using theatrical blood to show the jury how different kinds of blood spatter are created. Holding forth without interruption, he introduced the forensic discipline's basic principles and lexicon. Blood spatter analysis, he explained, allowed investigators to put the pieces of the puzzle together. And this is a huge part of criminal prosecutions and criminal defense, which I recently learned the magnitude of, which is that a court case is largely theater. It's like 20% facts and 20% what actually happened and 80% theater and performance and trying to get the jury to like you and be on your side. Or if you know that there's no chance that the facts are in your favor, you're just trying to discredit the witness as much as possible. You're trying to discredit the other side as much as possible. And I witnessed this, you know, not firsthand, but watching, I watched the entire prosecution and cross-examination of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. You know, like it was such performative bullshit. And I went into it with an open mind. I tried not to read a whole lot about the specifics of the trial. Obviously, I saw the headlines and stuff like that, but I just sat down and watched this 4 to 5 hour questioning and testimony. And you could just see how the prosecutor was flailing at Kyle Rittenhouse and asking all of these leading questions, and his mode quickly shifted into like, okay, this dude was clearly defending himself. How do I make this kid look stupid, or how do I get him to mess up? And to me, that is one of the biggest problems, if not the biggest problems of criminal cases, is that the incentive of the prosecutor is not to seek justice. The incentive of the prosecutor is to win and to maintain a winning record. And I wonder what percentage of prosecutors have a gut feeling, and maybe even an evidence-based feeling, that they are prosecuting an innocent man or woman, but they continue anyway because they want to win. And I'm all for competition. I grew up as an athlete. I'm very washed up now, but if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I spent 15 plus years of my life playing baseball, and I think healthy competition is great, but there shouldn't be competition when people's lives are at risk in a courtroom. It's weird to me that there's the way it's set up is this prosecution and defense, and the goal is to win. But if you take a step back and think about it, if the goal is justice, there is no winner and loser. The prosecution and defense should really just be working towards the same goal, which is justice. And if you both are on the side of justice, you both win. There should be none of this bullshit record criminal defense, winning mentality in the courtroom. And again, like, I know that's how the system works. I'm not blaming prosecutors. I'm not blaming lawyers. They're, you know, some are pieces of shit, but a lot of them are just doing what they need to do in a system that is set up the way it is. And unless the system changes, there's no way to get around it. I wasn't there in the courtroom with the Julie Rea case, but I'm imagining being on the jury, having no idea what blood spatter analysis is, and this enthusiastic police detective, not even a scientist, a police detective that has no scientific-based training in forensics, gets on the floor and is, you know, he's probably enthusiastic and he's giving me all this fancy vocabulary and lexicon and introducing me to all these different situations and how things have happened like this in the past, and this pointed to that, so that means this points to this, and so Julie Rea did it. And I don't fucking know, like, how am I supposed to distinguish what's performance-based theater and what's fact and what actually happened and what didn't if I'm just sitting at the jury on the whims of, you know, two thespians competing against each other in the form of a legal investigation and in the form of a court case, putting the pieces of the puzzle together, as the article says. It was with this imprimatur of legitimacy that Englert delivered his findings. And again, Englert is the retired police detective, and he was part of the prosecution. So he wanted to prove Rea guilty. It was with the imprimatur of legitimacy that Englert delivered his findings. He concluded that the crime scene had been, quote, staged and manipulated, and was, quote, not consistent with her story of struggle. His expert opinion was based on both his examination of the evidence, he said, and with his, quote, experience of having gone to many, many scenes, many like this, hundreds of scenes. He saw no indication that there was a third party in the residence. This sounds like the way that Trump would argue for a blood spatter investigation. Mr. President, what is your experience with situations like this in blood spatter analysis? I've been to hundreds of scenes. I said hundreds. It was great. I've been there hundreds of times, I said. It was great. Good people. Great experience. Hundreds of scenes. I said I've been there. It was great. Good people. And that is my terrible Trump impression, because I can't do one. My brother actually can. I wish he was there for it. But it's like, it's such a backwards thing. Like, if someone says, what is your experience? Like, what is your reason for coming to this conclusion? And you say, well, I've done this hundreds of times before. And it's like, you could just be having continuous bad experiences. Just because you do something 100 times doesn't mean you're gaining experience in doing things the right way. You can still, it's like if I'm applying to work at a sandwich shop and they say, what experience do you have making sandwiches? And I say, I've made over 1,000 barbed wire sandwiches. They would look at me and be like, we need to call the fucking cops right now. Because technically, I've made thousands of sandwiches, but no one wants a barbed wire sandwich unless they're a complete fucking psychopath sadist. That's hot. But you need experience doing things the right way. So even if this guy had spent to hundreds of scenes, if he's been employing terrible tactics and methods not based in scientific evidence, that makes it worse that he's been to hundreds of scenes, because that means there are more people sitting in jail based on absolutely nothing, or based on this pseudoscience practice of blood spatter analysis. The task of interpreting the bloodstains on Rea's t-shirt was left up to Dexter Bartlett, a crime scene investigator with the Illinois State Police. Bartlett told the jury that Joel's blood count could not have been transferred onto her shirt. Bartlett told the jury that Joel's blood could not have been transferred onto her shirt and was more consistent with her wielding a weapon. So Bartlett is another person on the prosecution. And so he said, it looks like, you know, this is from Julie Rea wielding the knife, actually stabbing her son. And Bartlett offered no proof of this. He also said, quote, no experiments conducted. There is no data or explanation of the methodology he used to come to these conclusions. So you have the combination of Englert and Bartlett going in front of the jury, presenting all this complicated vocabulary and all these situations, and I'm sure it was very entertaining and engaging, but when it came down to it, there was no proof. There were no experiments in blood spatter analysis. Like you would think that's such an easy thing to experiment on, because you could reverse engineer blood spatter analysis and see how good these blood spatter experts are. So you could have these fake crimes with fake blood, you know, put someone in a room, stab a fake body a bunch of times, shoot it, like have blood all over the place, and then put the body down, have the blood spatter expert come in, read the blood on the wall, and they have to tell you exactly what happened from start to finish. Like, was this a struggle? Were they stabbed? You know, what direction? Like, all the things that blood spatter analysis should be if it was a legitimate science. You should be able to reverse engineer crime scene based on the evidence at that crime scene. And so, I don't know, people may be doing this already, but like, why? You can't just come up with theories and then apply them in real life without practice. You have to test those theories when the stakes are not as high. So you have to create similar situations in rooms, like rent out rooms, you know, throw blood on the walls, like do all this, you know, shit, like act out a crime scene and then have the experts come in and tell you what happened. And if they can't do that, then probably don't use blood spatter, I would guess, you know. Find another way to do it, or maybe change it up a little bit. You know, it's like you get on the stand and you say all this shit. Or not get on the stand, but if you're a prosecutor and you're the blood spatter quote unquote expert, but your expertise is not based in science, it's kind of like a stand-up comedian getting on stage and telling a story. And it's a really good story. It's entertaining. It's engaging. And then there's always that one guy in the audience. It's like, that didn't happen. And in comedy, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't go to a stand-up show because I need facts. I go to a stand-up show to laugh, so I don't give a shit if a comedian's telling a story that didn't happen. I don't care. I just want to have a good time. It's like, that's how these blood spatter experts are treating a woman's life and a child's life. They're just like, yeah, we'll just, you know, maybe this happened, maybe it didn't, maybe there's some evidence, maybe there's not. Who knows? We didn't look into it, but we're going to tell you about it, and we'll make it seem like we did. There's a time and a place for telling a story. And there's a time and a place for presenting facts. And there's a time and a place for telling a story based on facts. And it seems like a courtroom would be that time. But, you know, again, I'm not an expert. Maybe you can just make shit up and convict people. So in the end, the jury found Rhea guilty. She was sentenced to 65 years in prison. Then in 2004, there was a sensational development in the case. This is wild. Serial killer Tommy Lynn Sells told Illinois investigators that he had broken into a house in 1997, stabbed a boy to death using a knife he pulled from a butcher block in the kitchen, and sparred with a woman both inside and outside the house. So a serial killer confesses to basically exactly what happened with Julie Rhea in the same location and is like, yeah, you guys are looking for someone who did this. I'm the guy. I've also done it 14 other times too. Sells, the serial killer, was facing execution in Texas for fatally stabbing a 13-year-old girl after breaking into her family's home. Sound familiar? And he had been linked to several other murders of children across the country. That same year, an Illinois appellate court overturned Rhea's conviction because of a legal error and ordered a new trial. So they didn't just, why not let her go at that point? This dude literally, like, unprovoked just came forward, it sounds like, and was like, yeah, I did that. And instead of apologizing to Julie Rhea for completely destroying her life and accusing her of murdering her son, they were like, yeah, we still need to retrial this. At her 2006 retrial, prosecutors doubled down on bloodstain pattern analysis. Again, this is with a serial killer who's murdered other children in a very similar fashion, confessing to the location and basically detailing the same thing from start to finish of what happened to Julie Reyes' son. The prosecutors hear that and are like, no, no, no. Believe in the bloodstain. Believe in the bloodstain. So the 2006 retrial, prosecutors doubled down on bloodstain pattern analysis when they once again put Englert on the stand. Englert is back, baby. Englert is fucking big dick swinging back in the stand. And by this time, Englert, who had delivered some of the state's most damning testimony in the Cam case, he focused on a theory that he had never mentioned at Reyes' first trial. So Englert had some time. He knows about the serial killer confession. In his head, like he's treating this like an exercise. This isn't a woman's life. He's just like, all right, this serial killer said this. I'm gonna come up with this. Like, he's at an improv class and the serial killer is like, I killed her. I was the one who did it. And he was like, yeah, you were the one who did it. I think this is what happened, and this is the blood stain, and this is what the blood says. In examining her t-shirt, he said that he had seen evidence that a, quote, bloody hand pushed up against it. The source of the blood, he said, could only have been Joel's bloodied hands. Could only have been. Again, this guy who's not even a scientist. He's a law enforcement officer. He went through police boot camp. And he's like, it could only have been. There's no other way. There's no other way. Trust me. I'm the blood guy. The source of the blood, he said, could only have been Joel's bloody hand. His testimony suggesting a horrifying scenario that Joel tried to push his mother away as she plunged a knife into him. Englert admitted under cross-examination that he had never requested measurements of Joe's hand for comparison. Can you imagine? Can you imagine you have a confession from a serial killer who's killed I don't know how many kids in the same way? And you're like, I think it was still the mom. It looks like it's the kid's handprint on her shirt. And... And you get asked, you're like, well, how do you know it was the kid's hand? Did you measure it? And Englert's like, nah. But it was, though. Like, hearing this, like, I used to think it would be impossible to make a living as a podcaster. And the silver lining in this is that Englert made a living as a blood spatter analysis expert. So anything is possible. Like, literally the bare minimum of evidence and work that you need to do your job. Englert is getting paid. Like, someone was sending this dude a paycheck every 2 weeks to get on a stand and be like, I think it was still the mom. And they asked him, like, how do you know? Did you do anything? And he's like, nah, but it was the mom. I'm not that scared anymore of making a living as a creative, because this guy can make a living. He's also very creative. Like, not though, because he didn't come up with a story about the dude. Like, I at least would have said, like, no, I couldn't measure the hand because it had already decomposed in the coffin or whatever, wherever this kid's body was, and or like he was cremated, whatever. They asked him, like, did you measure the hand, like the one thing that is riding on you against the serial killer's confession? And he was like, nah. Nah. Why would I measure the hand? It's just this woman's life getting sent to the electric chair. Why would I pull out a tape measure and spend 42 seconds doing my job when I could just send this woman to the chair and get my paycheck? Dude, prosecutors behave like fucking teenagers. They have their first opinion. Like, this guy went to the scene This guy went to the scene. I guarantee you, before this, the police officer slash bloodstain expert, whatever, I guarantee you he was watching a scene of Dexter. And right before this, he was binging season two of Dexter. And one of the episodes of Dexter was a mom who killed her son. And he had that playing in the back of his head. And he walked into the actual crime scene of Julie Reyes' son and was like, yo, I fucking know what this is. This was the fucking mom. And everyone else on the floor, like the interns that weren't allowed to speak up were like, should we dust the crime scene? And he was like, nah, it was the mom. Trust me, season two. And they're like, what? And he's like, it's good. Bag it up. We're done. And they're like, we don't have to bag anything. It's still an active crime scene. And he was like, shut the fuck up. Prosecutors are literally like teenagers because this guy formed his first opinion and then there was all this contrary evidence that was just shouting in his face and he was like, nah, I'm still going to go with the first one. I'm still going to go with the first thought that ran through my mind. Like, that's exactly how I behaved when I was a teenager. I would get a thought in my mind and then my parents would tell me like, this is not true and here's why. And I'd be like, nah, but I still going to go with that first thought. So this is the aftermath, the conclusion of the case. So thank God Julie Rea was found not guilty in the retrial. Thank God. She now has PTSD. She struggles to hold down a job and her life is an absolute mess, as you would expect. Her life would be a mess anyway, even just having your son brutally murdered. But then hours after your son is murdered and the cops show up and you're accused of it, like, just fucking imagine, dude, like your child is stabbed in the chest and the cops are like, we think you did it, and you're like, it wasn't me, like, what makes you think that? And there's like the hand that we didn't measure, and she's like, what? And they're like, go to jail. She also got $87,000 in compensation for spending 4 years of jail being accused of filleting her son and having her life destroyed. For all of that, she got the generous sum of $87,000 from the government. What a government we have. We're like, yeah, sorry for destroying your life. Here's about 1 year's survival. We sent you to jail for four. At minimum, she should have gotten $500,000. Like, at minimum. They also wrongly accused her of murdering her son. She has intense PTSD, may not be able to have a consistent job for the rest of her life. And they're just like, here's a few paychecks. Sorry about it. Today, the article wraps up with, today, Julie Rea belongs to a growing community of victims. Americans who were wrongly convicted with the help of forensic disciplines allowed into courtrooms despite little or no proof of their reliability. So obviously she's not the only one this happens to. This happens to literally hundreds of people. Of the 362 people who have been exonerated based on DNA tests in the United States, faulty forensics contributed to almost half of the underlying convictions. You would think that if something was responsible for 50% of things going wrong, that would come to an end almost immediately. Like, let's say 100 guys tore their ACL in the NBA last year, and 50% of those ACL injuries were caused by dance parties in the locker room, you would think, like, the next day, the owner of the NBA would be like, no dance parties. Like, wait till after the season. Like, immediately. If 50% of shit that goes wrong is attributed to a single thing that is obvious, any other situation, they'd be like, no, we're done. But apparently, you know, 50% is a good... It's a good percentage when sending people to jail. Giving people a death penalty. Yeah, like 50%, it's fine. And again, you know, wrapping up this episode, the prosecution incentive is so flawed. And I think it's because you are not going over evidence in a scientific manner, but you're trying to win. You're performing. It's theater. It's entertaining. It's engaging. You're trying to get the jury on your side, which is fine. I believe you should tell stories when you're presenting a case, because that is how people communicate. That's how people get pulled in. But that story needs to be based on fact. You shouldn't be allowed to just get up and tell a story in a courtroom to a jury who has no knowledge of the subject, and then just be able to throw words at them and fancy definitions and show them things that are not based in science at all. And then you just be like, and you decide. And whoever's the most convincing wins, and people die that shouldn't. People spend years of their life in jail that shouldn't. And what is, who wins in that besides the prosecutor? So I don't know. And again, I'm not saying that all lawyers are pieces of shit. Sure, everyone, there's going to be some percentage of pieces of shit in any industry, but this is a what seems like a systemic problem. This is not going away anytime soon unless the actual system changes in the courtroom that prevents people speaking on quote-unquote, you know, analysis that isn't actually based in any science. And I feel for people who go through this. I feel for Julie Rea. You know, I feel for her family. I feel for the victim, of course. Like, her son was tragically and brutally murdered by this serial killer. And the sad part is that this is going to keep happening. People will keep being wrongly convicted on blood spatter analysis and other types of analysis that are pseudoscience. And it's fucking terrible. But the positive thing is that, you know, I can talk about this to my own small corner of the world. I hope you guys read about it. Again, I just want to mention the name of the article one more time so you guys can go check it out. I just want to make sure I get it right. ProPublica, Julie Rea. Yeah, so here it is. Bloodstain analysis convinced a jury she stabbed her 10-year-old son. And again, it is ProPublica.org. Just search Julie Rea, R-E-A, ProPublica, and it'll show up on Google. You can follow along and read the article in full, which you should. I probably went through about like a quarter of it, if that. It's a long article. It's like a 30-minute read. And I will link that again, be linked in the YouTube audio description. If you would like bonus episodes, I put out bonus episodes on the Aux every month. And also give book recommendations, article recommendations. And it's a good time. It's on Supercast, augzoro.supercast.com. Again, augzoro.supercast.com. If you would like bonus episodes of the Aux on money, drugs, power, and crime, we're going to get into a different story every week. This week was bloodstain analysis, and, you know, next week could be LSD, could be Marilyn Manson, could be the Franklin scandal. I have a whole bunch of ideas, and I'm excited to get into it. Thank you so much, guys, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.